Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 11th, 2015, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Comfortably Numb: Low-Dose Ketamine as an Adjunct for Emergency Department Pain Control. And our guest skeptic today is Dr. Billy Sin, an assistant professor of the pharmacy practice, Arnold and Marie Schwartz College of Pharmacy and Health Science, Long Island University, clinical pharmacy educator in emergency medicine working at the Brooklyn Hospital Center. That is a mouthful. It sounds like you're working in all the five boroughs. Welcome to the SGEM, Billy.
Thanks, Ken. I'm happy to be here. Very, very excited. Let's talk about some emergency medicine.
Well, you know, I have a question. What is it about ED pharmacists that make them so great? I mean, we've had two really, really good ED pharmacists, Megan Groth and Nadia Awad, have already been on. And let me tell you, they have set the bar high. So, Billy, have you brought your A game to the SGEM today?
Let's set the bar higher.
Oh, that's what I like to hear, Billy. Well, today's episode, you know what we're going to do? We're going to combine an EM pharmacist with the SGEM hot off the press idea, which should make for some amazing FOMED. Now, normally, we're trying to cut that KT window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year. However, with that SGEM hop concept, we are taking it one step further and trying to cut that KT window down to how fast? Less than 1 week. And joining me, as always, on the SGEM hop issues is Dr. Chris Carpenter. How's it going, Captain Cranium?
Ken, I am awesome. It's 75 degrees, spring break is on the way, and we're going to spend some time with kids.
So Chris, let's remind everybody about the SGEM hop process.
Well, first, Ken, we pick a manuscript in conjunction with Academic Emergency Medicine's editorial board that has been submitted, peer-reviewed, and ultimately accepted for publication, but not published yet.
Yeah, and then we put the SGEM skeptical eye upon that manuscript using a modified Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine critical appraisal tool.
Yeah, and then third, Ken, one of the authors of the paper will be invited to discuss the strengths, weaknesses, limitations, and most importantly, clinical applications of their manuscript.
So, Billy, that's why you're here. The fourth thing is, as a special SGEM Hot Off the Press podcast, it'll be posted the week the journal gets published.
Yeah, and then fifth, Ken, the very best part of all, the SGEM audience, the listeners, get a chance to respond via the blog, Twitter, or on Facebook, but only for a week.
And then a summary of the SGEM critical appraisal gets published in a subsequent issue of AEM, including those top social media feedback. So get your feedback in fast.
Yeah, the last one we did was very cool. Sanjay Arora talking about the number needed to text.
Yeah, my favorite social media response from that was from an ED nurse. And he said something like, call me maybe, but text me always for ED follow-up. So here we go with our third SGEM hop. Billy, we always start these with a case. So can you give us the case you described in your systematic review?
Sure. Well, I'm sure everybody had this case one point or another. So let's say there was a 27-year-old female who presents to the emergency department again with, it's the same chief complaint, back pain, radiating to her legs, and you've tried everything imaginable. You tried analgesics, you tried anti-inflammatories, you even tried trigger point injections. But now you want to get a different perspective. You've been reading more and more papers about sub-dissociative dose of ketamine, and you wonder if you can apply it to this patient.
Oh, that's a great setup, because we've all seen patients like this. But let's take a step back and talk about ketamine first. It was first developed more than 50 years ago, and it's mainly used as an anesthetic agent. It has a number of other medical uses, including procedural sedation, which we use all the time in the emergency department, as well as for chronic pain syndromes like neuropathic pain or cancer pain. Since we have a pharmacist, Billy, here, I'm going to get you to tell the audience, what is ketamine and how does it work?
Sure. So ketamine is an NMDA receptor blocker, the N-methyl-D-aspartate receptor blocker. And in the realms of pain, what it does really is it binds the receptor and it blocks a series of chemical reactions that actually augments pain sensitivity. So in essence, what you can think of is ketamine is actually a blocker of pain sensitivity.
Hey, Billy, I've got two buddies from high school, Cheech and Chong, who said, hey man, ketamine also has some other non-medical uses. It's used as a street drug and goes by names like Special K and Cat Valium.
Was that your best Jeff Spicoli?
I was trying to do Cheech and Chong, dude.
Okay, you've got to work on that. Speaking of bad reputations, ketamine for years has had a bad reputation of raising intracranial pressure. But we had that EM pharmacist Megan Groth on episode number 93 to debunk that myth.
Ken, the SGEM bottom line from that episode 93 was ketamine seems to be a reasonable induction agent for undifferentiated patients who require rapid sequence intubation in the ED. Evidence to show that ketamine has negative effects on neurologic outcomes is weak and has been largely extrapolated from non-ED patients and non-ED settings. This systematic review found no compelling evidence that ketamine worsens intracranial pressure, cerebral perfusion pressure, or, most importantly, neurologic outcomes.
Yeah, and there is a group of doctors out there who would like to combine ketamine with propofol into ketafol. We actually have a podcast coming up on this topic with Steve Carroll from EM Basic. Before we get to the clinical question, I just want to give a shout out to Ming Le Kong, who suggested the Pink Floyd theme music, Comfortably Numb.
Excellent choice.
That was the very first album I ever owned. So what's the clinical question today, Chris?
The question is the administration of subdissociative dose ketamine for acute pain control safe and effective compared with placebo?
And since we have the lead author, I will get you to read out the reference, Billy.
So our reference today is by myself, one of my colleagues, Dr. Deologia Ternis, and my mentor, Dr. Sergey Motov. The title is The Use of Subdissociative Dose Ketamine for Acute Pain in the Emergency Department.
So since this is a systematic review, the population is papers, original studies, and the original studies were English language, randomized controlled trials assessing adult or pediatric ED patients with acute pain.
And so the intervention was ketamine 0.2 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram IV over 3 to 10 minutes versus placebo. And then one trial used morphine 0.1 milligram per kilogram with the ketamine.
Yeah, the comparison varied across the four studies. One trial used morphine at a dose of 0.1 milligram per kilogram and then repeat doses at 4 hours. Another used morphine and placebo. One used midazolam at a dose of 0.1 milligram per kilogram IV plus fentanyl 0.5 mics per kilo. And another used fentanyl 1.5 mics per kilo.
And their outcome, their primary outcome, was difference in pain scores. Their secondary outcome was incidence of adverse events and reduction of adjuvant opioids. Now, this is one of the favorite parts of the SGEM hop for me. I get to hear the conclusions without me quoting, but actually getting the author to give their conclusion. So, Billy, what did you guys conclude?
All right, so our conclusion was the data failed to provide convincing evidence to either support or refute the use of subdissociative dose ketamine for management of acute pain in the ED. The decision to initiate subdissociative dose ketamine should be based on assessments of potential risks and benefits and on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you, Billy. So let's go through the quality checklist for therapeutic systematic reviews, Chris.
The first question, is the clinical question sensible and agreeable? I agree that it is. Number two, is the search for studies detailed and exhaustive? We had some questions there that we'll talk about. Number three, are the primary studies of high methodologic quality? No, they're not. Number four, is the assessment of studies reproducible? We were unsure, and we'll get to that in a minute. Number five, are the outcomes clinically relevant? Certainly they are, we agree. Number six, was there low statistical heterogeneity for the primary outcomes? Unsure, probably not, because they're very different studies. And number seven, finally, was the treatment effect large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant? And we thought not.
All right, so let's go through the key results. There were four randomized control trials totaling 428 patients that were identified and met the inclusion criteria.
Yeah, the authors, Billy and company, used the grade criteria, and the authors noted that the overall quality of evidence was low to moderate, with potential biases including small sample sizes, lack of or compromised blinding, and lack of randomization completely.
In addition, the various trials used various doses of ketamine and a comparator opioid analgesics, as well as different pain scales.
Yeah, for the primary outcomes, two studies, Messinger in 2008 and Galinsky in 2007, demonstrated no detectable differences in pain scores.
Yeah, and one study reported, quote, significantly lower pain scores, but systematic review authors do not provide absolute values or numbers needed to treat estimates.
Yeah, and the only pediatric paper by Kennedy in 1998 reported reduction in the scale they used called the Observational Scale of Behavioral Distress, and that was comparing ketamine to fentanyl.
For the secondary outcomes of adverse events, Kennedy et al. Reported higher incidence of post-treatment pediatric vomiting in ketamine versus midazolam, with a number needed to treat of 17, but Gernani reported no vomiting in adults.
Yeah, Gernani reported significantly increased use of rescue therapy, though, and the systematic review doesn't tell us what the rescue therapy is. I'm not sure if Gernani even described what they meant by rescue therapy, but whatever they meant by it, they reported that there's rescue therapy with when they use morphine in 18 out of 20, compared with ketamine, 0 out of 20. So when all of the patients in one arm have this bad outcome and needing rescue therapy, and the other arm does not, that approaches a number needed to treat of 1.
And across all four studies, only one case of emergent phenomenon was reported, and all reported adverse events were transient without requiring prolonged evaluation or hospitalization.
Mm-hmm. And for the secondary outcome, assessing the amount of adjuvant opioids consumed, both Galinsky and Gernani reported a significant reduction in the amount of morphine consumed or requested.
All right, so let's start going through this with Billy with some comments here from our Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. First and foremost, I want to congratulate Billy on getting this study done and published. It's hard to do research, and systematic reviews can be especially challenging. But now, let's go through, after I've buttered you up with that statement, Billy.
Batter up!
About the limits of the search strategy. And I noticed that you limited your search to English language. Were there any considerations to search non-English literature?
No, to be honest with you. It's just so hard. I am bilingual. Dr. Modoff is also bilingual. But we're just, you know, we didn't know where to tackle, you know, for example, Russian papers or Chinese papers. Or even Dr. Turner's, she's pretty proficient in Greek. And we didn't know if there was any, you know, Greek, you know, reputable databases that we can really use out there. So, you know, we want to limit our scope to the practice here in North America. So we decided to go with English language papers.
Okay, so that was the softball one to warm you up. That was the easy question. Now we're going to get into the five hard questions. So here's the first question. You searched only two electronic search engines, Medline and Embase. Why did you not expand your search to include databases like Cochrane Collaboration or clinicaltrials.gov?
That's you hit it on the nail. I think that's a great question. You know, let's start with Cochrane. We really didn't have a particular reason really for not choosing Cochrane out of our research team. The three of us felt that we'll be most comfortable using Medline Embase. It's really what we use day in and day out. With clinicaltrials.gov, we really wanted to have, published sought-out literature. So we really wanted to tell folks out there what's there now, you know, what is published and what is searchable now. And that was really our goal of this paper, is to tell the audience what's out there now that we can work off on.
Now, Chris, is there some limits? You do a lot of these library searches and these systematic reviews. Are there some limits that Embase and Medline will miss?
Oh, for sure. There's not 100% overlap, and most notably when you get outside the English language. I try to always use a medical librarian on our systematic reviews, and always, every single one I've done, they come up with hundreds of search strategy ideas, both terms and search engines that I've never even heard of. So that's one of the things I do with my systematic reviews is cheat, and I use a medical librarian.
Those medical librarians, they are wonderful. The other question I had about the search strategy is, did you consider searching the gray literature? Why not look mm-hmm. at research abstracts, mm-hmm. which you specifically excluded, you said, in the mm-hmm. discussion, and why not contact some experts in the field?
So I'll start off with the first part of the question. In terms of research abstracts, we didn't think that research abstracts would give us necessarily the information that we were seeking. And with experts in the field, again, you know, our focus and our, you know, what we want to do for this paper is we want to show people, we want to show the audience out there is what is published there now. So we wanted some, you know, if there were any, some reputable trials and more so than expert opinions, if that makes sense.
Sure. I hear what you're talking about. But sometimes those experts can point you to other papers that they have.
Yeah, when I do my systematic reviews, sometimes the authors have unpublished data that they'll release to us, and we can do individual patient data analysis. So I often find it beneficial to at least shoot an email to authors within about 5 or 10 years of their publication.
All right, so my third question, Billy, there are guidelines for reporting systematic reviews, and one mm-hmm. is called the PRISMA guidelines, the preferred reporting mm-hmm. items for systematic reviews and meta-analysis. You seem to have done many of the 27 things on their PRISMA checklist. I'm wondering, why didn't you explicitly follow the PRISMA guidelines and talk about that?
That's another great question. I'm really at the batter's box here. So this seems like a fastball, 95 miles per hour. You know, in essence, I think that's a great point. I think with this type of paper, you can use PRISMA, you can use other rubrics out there, other guidelines out there. You know, our team really felt that grade really met our needs. We really felt that this paper is going to be a startup paper. What I mean by that, it's going to get people interested. It's going to get people to start doing more research. So we wanted some criteria where it was simple for the audience to read and simple for the audience to understand. And we really felt that grade really met our needs for this paper.
Yeah, you mentioned the GRADE instrument to assess quality. You chose this instrument as opposed to Cochrane. I'm sensing that you have sort of some kind of bias against the Cochrane collaboration.
No, nothing personal. It's just we wanted the audience to include a lot of different disciplines. The journal is dedicated for EM personnel, specifically more so for sometimes for physicians. But we really wanted to get everyone who's interested in emergency medicine to read this article. Now, that can include anybody from a physician, to a nurse, to an NP, to a med student, pharmacist, anyone who's involved with looking at pain treatment in itself in the ED, or even patients can read this paper. We really wanted to use an instrument that's easy for everyone to read out there.
All right. Well, this is my last and fifth question, mm-hmm. Billy, and then we'll get Chris involved here. There were only 4 randomized clinical control trials included, and they were of low to moderate quality. So I'm mm-hmm. wondering, why did you not include some of the observational studies and do a pre-planned sub-study mm-hmm. analysis of the randomized clinical control trials and mm-hmm. observational trials to sort of broaden the reader's understanding of the mm-hmm. published literature out there?
So that's another 95 miles per hour fastball.
Oh, I am in the zone, Billy. I am in the zone tonight.
So, I think that's another valid point. And, you know, when we did this literature search, we did come up with some observational studies. But again, we wanted to go back with our goal of, telling the audience out there what is the best available data that's out there now. So we decided to go with randomized controlled trials. That's not to say that the observational trials don't tell us, any information of importance. They certainly do.
Okay, Billy, shake it off, relax, get ready, because up comes Chris Carpenter.
Billy, when I was mm-hmm. reading through your paper, you put in your conclusion paragraph that this review highlights the need for well-designed clinical studies to further examine the potential benefits of subdissociative dose ketamine. I agree. What I really wanted to know, though, was specific recommendations for future investigators in this field.
Chris, that's a great question. It's funny with pain, because pain is such a subjective pathophysiology that, you have to subjectively treat the problem. So, with future research, what we want to really look at and, recommendations for people who are interested outside right now is, start looking at the different doses of subdissociative dose ketamine. We had a range that we found in this paper. Let's now start looking at, the different dosages. For example, 0.3. Versus can we go up to 0.5 versus should we go back down to 0.2? The other interest for researchers out there is what's the route that we want to give this medication? And also monitoring parameters, if you look at ketamine itself, the onset is from anywhere from 1 to 3 minutes. So you want to take a look at to see if higher doses versus lower doses versus different routes of administration would change that.
One of the studies you included was by Bo Kennedy, who's my colleague at WashU, and I consider him a world expert on pediatric procedural sedation in the ED. Mm-hmm. Some of the earliest work in the field is his work. He noted to me when I discussed this with them that ketamine and procedural sedation research in general is fraught with small details that make big differences, details mm-hmm. that I didn't even think about when I was reading your paper. For example, he noted that the dose of ketamine used for subdissociative purposes is still uncertain. I thought it was a given, you know, the range you gave in the papers. But he said that one of our colleagues also at WashU, Dr. Sri Shinta, has an in-press manuscript at Annals of Emergency Medicine that finally tests the appropriate pediatric ketamine dose using explicit methods. So how important do you think that this dose-finding study will be for future ketamine researchers?
Oh, it'll be huge. You know, when you look at ketamine, you know, like I said before, there's some pharmacokinetic parameters that you need to look at to consider the dose. And it's great that paper's coming out.
And Bo Kennedy also raised the concern that none of the studies really controlled for how fast the ketamine was given, whether it's pushed, like I give it, to adults in my ED, or titrated to effect, where Bo, with his kids in his pediatric ED, just sits there continuously and pushes a little bit, a little bit, a little bit, until he sees the effect that he wants. How important do you think that really assessing push versus titrate explicitly will be?
Oh, that's going to be important. That's going to be very, very important. Actually, at the Brooklyn Hospital Center right now, we're actually conducting two ketamine studies. One, giving us IV piggyback over 15 minutes. Most of the study out there actually gave ketamine for IV push. Now, there's some suggestions to say that, well, if you give IV push, that may increase the nausea and vomiting. So we're looking at different modalities to see if we're giving it slowly or slower, would that actually help with some of the side effects that we may see? And Chris, you hit it on the nail with titration. I mean, one of the things that I think we can do a lot better in all EDs across the board is make sure we're titrating to effect. So, you know, the method, the route of administration and the way how we're going to titrate the drug versus how we're going to monitor the patient are going to be very pertinent information and pertinent factors.
And Bo also hypothesized that ketamine's effectiveness might depend on the type of pain based upon studies that he's read in the OR setting. Mm-hmm. Like he looked at musculoskeletal versus visceral abdominal pain versus neuropathic pain. Did any of the studies that you assessed evaluate ketamine effectiveness stratified by the type of pain?
Most of the studies that we looked at used it for example, musculoskeletal, abdominal, abscesses. They didn't really stratify it to the way that we probably both wanted him to stratify it. There are a lot of literature out in the OR setting, and they're really using it for neuropathic pain. There is some degree of belief that the neuropathic pain is involved with the NMDA receptor. So there is data out there to support the use of ketamine, you know, with neurologic pain or neuropathic pain.
So future investigators in the ED studying ketamine are probably going to want to do those stratified analyses then. And then yes. I also talked to one of my toxicologists, Bill Dribben, who's a researcher with NMDA receptors. And he told me that the subdissociative doses of ketamine can hypothetically produce a schizophrenia-like symptoms in some normal patients, which I wasn't aware of. I thought if you're going to have that sort of adverse reaction to ketamine, doesn't matter what dose, you're just prone to it. But his hypothesis is that lower dose ketamine makes you more likely to have that than higher doses. Do you think that this hypothesis is plausible enough to evaluate in future ketamine studies?
Oh, I think it's certainly possible. If you look at the literature that we found, three of the four trials actually reported neuropsychological events. Now, some gave description, some did not give description, so we can't really rule it out. Now, if you go back to how ketamine works, you know, the analgesic effects is due to the, you know, NMDA antagonism, but the neuropsychological effects that we see, sometimes it's because of the suppression of the limbic system. There's also some thought that some of the auditory hallucination or contributory factors to schizophrenia-like symptoms is due to a depression of the inferior colliculus, which is the midbrain nucleus of the auditory pathway. So think of ketamine as suppressing these systems. So these are all processing centers for sensory input. By depressing the system, your central nervous system is now unable to receive or process sensory information. You know, the adverse effects that we see, you know, with ketamine, it's not so much related to the NMDA receptor. You know, in fact, you know, Chris, you mentioned Bo Kennedy before. You know, in his study, he actually reported nightmares, vomiting, hallucinations, and even one case of emergence. Right. And he used a dose of 0.5 milligrams per kilo every 3 minutes until 2 milligrams per kilo were given. So I think it's certainly possible.
All right. So I think it's time to take Billy off the hot seat in this hot off pressed. Yep. Well done.
I'm off the batter's box.
And so now, Chris, I'm going to ask you to comment on our conclusions compared to the author's conclusions.
Yeah, we agree that published randomized controlled trial data neither supports or refutes the ED effectiveness or safety of subdissociative dose ketamine to manage acute pain in children or adults. So the bottom line, our SGEM bottom line, high quality published evidence to support the use of subdissociative dose ketamine to quickly reduce acute pain in ED settings is lacking. But lower quality studies inconsistently demonstrate effectiveness with uniformly low risk of adverse effects.
All right, Billy, do you want to give us a case resolution to that 27-year-old woman who you threw the kitchen sink at to get rid of her back pain?
So sure. You discussed the issue of subdissociative dose ketamine with the patient. She agrees to give it a try to see if it will help her back pain.
So from a clinical application standpoint, the current published evidence should neither encourage nor dissuade the use of subdissociative dose ketamine as an adjunct to acute pain control in the emergency department. But keep in mind that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Well said.
But Chris, what are you going to tell your patient?
Well, many options exist to alleviate your pain in the ED today. One choice is intravenous ketamine, which several small and potentially flawed studies indicate may quickly reduce your pain while also reducing the amount of other pain medications that you require today. In children, 1 in 17 may vomit as a result of the ketamine, who otherwise wouldn't have vomited, but few other significant side effects have been reported.
And that sound reminds me that it's time for the Keener contest. Last week's winner was Jay Taylor from my own university, Western University. Jay knew that captopril was the first ACE inhibitor approved by the FDA. Chris, what is the gunner question this week?
Ken, the question this week, and I'm not going back to Cheech and Chong or Spicoli. Ketamine was first synthesized in 1962 by Kelvin Stevens at Park Davis Labs. He was searching for PCP anesthetic replacements. It was not called ketamine in the 1960s, but rather an alphanumeric designation. So the gunner question is, what was the alphanumeric designation for ketamine?
Ooh, excellent. Ooh. And challenging question, Chris. So if you know the answer and want a chance to win a cool skeptical prize, then send me an email, thesgem@gmail.com, with gunner in the subject line. The first correct answer will win the prize. Thanks again, Chris, for doing another edition of the SGEM Hop.
No problem, Ken. And remember, everybody, tweet out your comments. Write feedback on the blog. The best social media responses will be published in a future AEM journal.
And thank you, Billy, for coming on the SGEM and being on the hot seat and helping us feel comfortably numb about the use of ketamine for acute pain in the emergency department.
Great. Thank you so much for having me tonight.
Now, somebody may have warned you, but I get our guest skeptics to give the tagline, and I always like to hear all these American accents. So I was wondering, can you dig deep and give the SGEM tagline?
I'll do my best. So I'm going to try and give a Brooklyn accent, because that's where I work. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it, on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
That was great. Talk to everyone next week.